And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. On March 3rd, I want to encourage you to have a pencil and paper handy. So while you're getting that, we'll get on with the announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, March 5th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Baldwin Creek Wilder Ranch State Park. Back to this pretty coastal place to continue work on Cape Ivy removal. We will also whack away on various weedy mustard species that are surely bolting in the recent warm rainless weather over the last month. See you at Wilder Ranch for carpooling to the site. The directions are to take Highway 1 through Santa Cruz to the west and then continue north to the turnoff on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch. Watch for the sign that indicates the left turn. Once at the kiosk, let the person there know you are volunteering as a habitat restoration person and they will give you a parking pass. Meet us at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot for that carpool. Please be prompt at 10 a.m. this Saturday, March 5th. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing. I would bring a raincoat this weekend, also bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They do work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring those gloves and your water. If you have questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Or you could email her at redwdrn@packbell.net. That's redwdrn@packbell.net. Or visit their webpage, www.cruzcnps.org. And taking place March 18th through the 20th is the Appalachia Resist Social and Environmental Justice Action Camp. In this release from Appalachia Resist, as found in the Earth First Newswire, Appalachia Resist is a small group of rural activists who use direct action as a tactic to resist the fracking industry in our region. We work and live in a rural working class community that is predominantly white. We see that struggles for environmental justice and the ongoing fight for racial justice are linked. We want to articulate that link and find concrete ways to work together to push back against a system that brutalizes and sees as disposable the bodies of low-income rural people, people of color, non-gender conforming people, women, native, and undocumented people. Mentioning all these people together should not be a way of erasing difference. This is not all lives matter, but a way of seeking actual solidarity based on mutual liberation. This is a monumental task, and we are definitely not experts, but we think it's important and necessary. We are hosting an action camp March 18th, 19th, and 20th, the theme of which is connecting environmental justice and social justice efforts in our region. We are hoping that the camp can be a place where organizers from different issues can swap or pool trainings, can offer skills and strengths from their campaigns, and also seek further skills training that could help their efforts. We are hoping to include trainings from regional activists working on racial justice, anti-rape culture, prison solidarity and prison abolition, environmental justice and anti-extraction, and more. Please RSVP by March 7th to appalachia.resist@gmail.com. That's appalachia.resist@gmail.com. That way they can plan their food, child care, and accommodations. Once again, the Appalachia Resist Social and Environmental Justice Action Camp, March 18th to the 20th. If you want more information, go to www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. There are now approximately 75 wild buffalo inside Yellowstone National Park's Stevens Creek Bison Trap. Since capture operations began on February 20th, no buffalo have yet been sent to slaughter, but Yellowstone spokespeople tell us that this is likely to occur next week. It is also probable that Yellowstone will conduct one of the two media tours they promised. Buffalo Field Campaign will be in attendance. It is going to be extremely difficult for us to see what these buffalo suffer as they are run through this gauntlet of torture, but it is critical that the public know what Yellowstone is doing on behalf of livestock interests to the buffalo that they are mandated to protect. This particular media tour will allow the public for the first time in over a decade to witness a very brief glimpse of buffalo being processed inside the tramp, something Yellowstone really doesn't want the public to see. Buffalo Field Campaign's media coordinator Stephanie Shea and the acclaimed journalist Christopher Ketchum, represented by the Animal Legal Defense Fund, have filed a lawsuit against Yellowstone National Park in an attempt to gain full access to the trap for the public and media during the times when the bison operations are being conducted. Why does Yellowstone want to kill America's last wild buffalo? There's no justification for it, no matter what the Park Service tells you. Wild bison are not overpopulated, and the so-called brucellosis threat is a livestock industry smokescreen being used to kill wild buffalo and prevent them from being naturally restored on the landscape. Please continue to call and email Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Dan Wank and demand that he cease catering to the livestock industry intolerance, release the captured buffalo, and end all plans to slaughter. His email address, dan_wenk@nps.gov, that's dan_wenk@nps.gov, or yell_superintendent@nps.gov, that's yell_superintendent@nps.gov, or you can make the phone call to 307-344-2002. That phone number for Yellowstone National Park Superintendent Dan Wenk, 307-344-2002. With endless pressure endlessly applied, we can end livestock industry control and help regain wild buffalo their rightful ancestral place on the landscape. Buffalo Field Campaign spokesperson Goodshield Aguilar calls for more tribal voices in defending the country's last wild buffalo. A nephew of Buffalo Field Campaign's co-founder and Lakota elder Rosalie Little Thunder, Goodshield speaks about the sacred nature of the buffalo, Yellowstone's ongoing capture for slaughter and quarantine plan, and urges more tribal people to help the buffalo. This interview was conducted last Thursday in the windy Gardner Basin overlooking Yellowstone's bison capture facility. We also want to thank you for submitting comments on Yellowstone's 50-year buffalo quarantine environmental assessment during the now-closed comment period. We hope that everyone had a chance to review Buffalo Field Campaign's official comments, and we also wanted to share with you some really powerful comments submitted by the Western Watersheds Project, one of the only other groups beside Buffalo Field Campaign who spoke out against the domestication and commercialization of America's last wild buffalo. The next steps in the process are for Yellowstone to conduct an analysis of all the public comments, then they will prepare a decision document including responses to your comments, and lastly, they will release their decision notice. It is unclear what the timetable is for those next steps, but the Buffalo Field Campaign will keep you posted. Buffalo Field Campaign's website is www.buffalofieldcampaign. Check it out. There's a lot of information there, including what they need, including volunteers. And if you want to send a donation to the Buffalo Field Campaign, send it to P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. That address again, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. You can reach them at 406-646-0070. That's 406-646-0070. www.buffalofieldcampaign.org is their webpage. And do remember that the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And unfortunately, indigenous activist Berta Caceres has been killed in Honduras in this story from the Global Justice Ecology Project as found on the Earth First Newswire. Berta Caceres of the indigenous organization COPINH of Honduras was a longtime ally from before the Global Justice Ecology Project when we were working as a CERCA. She was a powerful force and a tremendously effective organizer. This is a horrible loss and another example of the danger of being an indigenous organizer taking on big companies and governments over the destruction of indigenous lands. Berta Caceres, the coordinator and co-founder of the Council of Indigenous Peoples of Honduras, was killed by an unknown assailant early Thursday morning in her home. Telesur correspondent in Honduras, Gilda Silvestrucci, confirmed that Caceres was killed at 1 a.m. local time inside her home in La Esperanza in the western province of Intibucá. Caceres was a leader of the Lenca indigenous community and was a staunch human rights defender. She won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize in 2015. Berta Caceres has been killed. And you can find more information at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And SeaWorld admits to using its own employees to spy on animal rights activists in this story from Common Dreams as found on the Earth First Newswire. SeaWorld CEO Joel Manby has for the first time admitted that the company's workers have posed as animal rights activists to spy on critics of the park's treatment of captive marine creatures. Manby made the admission during an investor relations call on Thursday, saying, according to the Orlando Sentinel, that the company's board has directed management to end the practice in which certain employees posed as animal welfare activists. This activity was undertaken in connection with efforts to maintain the safety and security of employees, customers, and animals in the face of credible threats. The acknowledgement follows a claim in 2015 by the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals that animal rights activist Thomas Jones was in fact SeaWorld employee Paul T. McComb, who had worked his way into a network of San Diego area activists concerned with the company's ongoing orca captivity and breeding programs, animal news site The Dodo reports. Jones was fond of inflammatory rhetoric and appeared to be trying to incite the activists to violence. "It's time for direct action against SeaWorld," one tweet by Jones read. "I need to find a way to personal stop them. I will be coming." There are a number of red flags related to this individual, Lindsay Rutsch, spokesperson for PETA, told the Dodo at the time. Any genuine animal advocate is not going to go on social media saying things like burn SeaWorld to the ground and drain the tanks. But McComb remains an employee of SeaWorld, has returned to work at SeaWorld in a different department, and is no longer on administrative leave, Manby's statement added. The amusement park has long been subject of criticism for its treatment of animals, including the small size of the tanks the animals are kept in and worker treatment of the animals. Scrutiny over the park also came to the big screen with the 2013 release of the documentary Blackfish, which focuses on the captivity of one orca. SeaWorld's latest report confirms not only that the company has employed more than one spy to infiltrate and agitate at PETA, but also that it values its spies more highly than the executives who have their heads chopped off in droves, as at least one of the spies is still working at the company, PETA said in a Thursday statement. SeaWorld's finances continue to flop as animals continue to be found dead in its tiny tanks, with one death every single month since November, the statement continued. If SeaWorld has business savvy or common sense, it would modernize its business with coastal sanctuaries and virtual reality displays instead of building more roller coasters and dolphin prisons. For more information, go to www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And the last toothfish poacher ship, the Viking, has been arrested in Indonesia in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. The hunt for the last of the six known toothfish poaching vessels has ended with the arrest of the Nigerian-flagged Viking in Indonesia. The announcement of the vessel's arrest was made at a press conference in Jakarta, held by Indonesian Fisheries Minister Susi Pujastuti, the commander of the Western Naval Fleet, and other high-ranking Indonesian officials. Officials stated that the Viking has been detained for entering Indonesian waters without permission and for falsifying its name. The ship's captain, Juan Vanessa of Chile, and its crew of 10 from Indonesia, Chile, Argentina, Myanmar, and Peru have also been detained. The Viking has been a target of Sea Shepherd's 12th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish 2015-16. Last week, Sea Shepherd's campaign leader, Captain Siddhartha Chakravarti, notified officials in Indonesia of the suspected entry of the Viking into Indonesian waters. At the press conference, Minister Susi revealed that the Viking was located in the waters around the Riau Islands by the Indonesian Navy. Indonesian officials again reiterated their strong stance against illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing, vowing to sink the Viking if the vessel was found to be in breach of international and national laws. Captain Chakravarti said Indonesia has once again demonstrated a strong commitment to ensure that IUU fishing vessels and operators will not be welcome in its waters. Minister Susi has clearly stated that she intends to sink the Viking for crimes related to illegal fishing. Such swift government action is vital in ending the destructive streak of IUU vessels. The Viking is one of six toothfish poaching operators known to illegally fish vulnerable populations of Antarctic and Patagonian toothfish in the Southern Ocean. These six vessels, which Sea Shepherd named the Bandit Six, had been operating with impunity for more than 10 years, able to avoid detection and arrest by frequently changing their names and registries, and by exploiting the remoteness of the Southern Ocean shadowlands where monitoring and surveillance is difficult. In 2013, the Viking, which was then called the Snake, was the first fishing vessel to be issued with an Interpol purple notice for fishing-related violations following a petition by authorities in Norway. The owners and operators of the Viking are suspected of violating national laws and regulations as well as international conventions by engaging in fraud and fisheries-related crime. The Viking was last boarded by the Australian customs officers in September of 2015 on its way to Antarctica. With the return of the Viking to Indonesian waters and its subsequent arrest, all of the toothfish poaching vessels have been put out of action. The successful chase and the deliberate sinking of the Thunder, followed by the evidence handover in the trial in the case of her officers, has firmly established Sea Shepherd's reputation as being steadfast in their role to see the poachers through to the very end. This reputation has directly resulted in the return of the Viking back to shore earlier than ever before. In a short span of 15 months, the entire fleet of the toothfish poachers is in disarray, with no poachers fishing in Antarctica for the first time. International cooperation, spearheaded by Sea Shepherd's at-sea campaigns, has directly resulted in one of the swiftest and biggest successes in marine conservation history. For further information, go to www.seashepherd.org.au. And Iceland's fin whale hunt has been canceled for 2016 in this story by William McKinsey of EcoWatch, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Great news. Word today from colleagues in Iceland and now reports from both Icelandic and English language media confirm that the planned hunt for fin whales will not happen this summer. The man behind that whaling is claiming that he's stopping because of hindrances in exporting the meat. That's great news for whales and everyone who has been opposed to this needless, senseless hunt. Fin whales are amazing. The second largest animal on our planet grows up to 27 meters in length. That's about 90 feet. And is found all over the globe. They're nicknamed the Greyhounds of the Sea because they are sleek, streamlined swimming machines. They are listed as internationally endangered, largely because their massive whales were some of the first targets of the harpoons of factory whaling in the 20th century, and their populations were virtually wiped out in many areas. Over the past few years, Iceland has defied international opinion and public outcry and allow one man, Christian Loftsson, to restart a fin whale hunt. This hunt of an internationally endangered species is quite impossible to defend. It makes no environmental, economic, or social sense to Iceland. There is no market for the meat in Iceland. The blubber, and often more, is discarded as being unfit for human consumption, and the tentative trade to Japan makes no sense, not least since they have stockpiles of unwanted whale meat and are concerned about toxic pollution. Greenpeace supporters have played a crucial role in highlighting and even blockading some of these illicit shipments. When tens of thousands of supporters raised their voices for whales, President Obama imposed diplomatic sanctions on Iceland. And activists have blocked ports in the Netherlands and Germany and challenged shipments through Canada, exposed desperate shipment through the Arctic, and mobilized massive public support to block whale meat trade to South Africa. And let's not forget that there is no economic rationale for these hunts, and this trade in fin whales are supposed to be protected species international. As well as that, whales and other marine life in the North Atlantic have been shown to suffer particularly badly from toxins. That's why people are advised to avoid eating whale blubber or too many portions of fatty fish. And recent studies suggest that some populations of whales in the North Atlantic might eventually go extinct as a result of pollution alone. Over recent decades, tourism has become much more a significant economic activity in Iceland than whaling could ever be, and the growth of whale watching has been one of the greatest success stories of all. Iceland is now a destination synonymous with scenery and wildlife, which increasingly brought the tourist industry into conflict with Lofsen's ego-driven hunt. There is simply no place today for commercial whaling, and the world's remaining whales, dolphins, and porpoises play a whole host of threats from us humans that we collectively aren't tackling, from climate change to pollution and industrial fishing. Stopping the senseless charade of commercial whaling for good needs to happen so that we can get on with other stuff. So when Lofsen says he is stopping because of hindrances, it sounds like a very diplomatic version of truth to save face. But let's hope that the canceling of this year's hunt is the end of this indefensible outrage for good. That would be even better news for whales, for Iceland, and for the oceans. And you can get more information at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And a lawsuit is challenging the West Side logging plan in this story from the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Kurok Tribe, along with the Environmental Protection Information Center, Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center, Center for the Biological Diversity, and the Klamath River Keeper, have filed suit in federal court challenging a massive post-fire logging plan in Klamath National Forest that will increase fire danger, degrade water quality, and harm at-risk salmon populations. The tribe leads a diverse plaintiff group, united by a common interest in restoring healthy relationships between people, fire, forests, and fish. The group seeks to protect rural communities from fire risks, restore watershed health, and provide economic opportunities for locals. The group is challenging a post-fire timber sale, the West Side Project, which fails river communities by implementing the same management practices that have for decades resulted in a landscape prone to dangerous fire events, degraded water quality, and contributed to declining salmon populations. The suit alleges the Klamath National Forest Plan, as approved by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries, illegally increases the risk of extinction for threatened populations of coho salmon. The West Side Project would clear-cut 6,800 acres of burned forest slopes above tributaries of the Klamath River. This aggressive approach would fail to resolve long-term fire management issues and exacerbate wildfire impacts on recovering watersheds. The steep and rugged terrain contains old-growth forests and nurtures some of the most important salmon habitat on the West Coast. NOAA Fisheries is required to review Forest Service logging plans to determine if such projects will have harmful effects on ESA-listed coho. In this case, NOAA Fisheries green-lighted the Forest Service plan, despite the obvious harm to coho spawning and rearing habitat. This project was ill-conceived from the start and failed to adequately take into account the input of the Kurok tribe, which has managed these forests since the beginning of time, said Kurok Chairman Russell Buster Atterbury. We will not allow the Forest Service to further degrade our fisheries, water quality, or sacred sites while ignoring our call for community fire protection. The tribe's alternative proposal ensures that future fire events will be healthy for the environment and safe for local residents while providing marketable timber. The Forest Service did not analyze the correct alternative because it rushed the environmental review process under the pretense of a public emergency. Unlike the massive Forest Service clear-cutting plans, the correct alternative focuses on restoration, explains George Sexton of the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center. It recognizes the need to restore watersheds and the natural fire regime while protecting homes and communities. The Klamath River and its tributaries are strongholds for struggling salmon populations. They are also home to many rare and endemic species. Logging these steep slopes would only increase the perilous position our fisheries and wildlife are facing, said Kimberly Baker of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Forest Service plan to clear cut thousands of acres above the Klamath River disregards the reasonable correct alternative and hurts at-risk salmon and river communities, said Carol Dyer of the Klamath River Keeper. A healthy Klamath River requires sensible forest restoration that addresses the needs of both fish and people, like that laid out in the correct plan. We have a chance right now to restore healthy relationships among people, fire, and forest, said Jay Leninger, senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. It requires a fundamentally different approach from what the Forest Service put forward. The groups are challenging the illegal harm to fish and watersheds that will result from the proposed post-fire clear-cutting timber sales in hopes that the federal government will change course. Initial arguments will likely be heard by the district court in a very near future. The Western Environmental Law Center represents all of the plaintiffs, and EPIC is represented by in-house counsel. For more information, please visit www.wildcalifornia.org. And in this story from the Center for Biological Diversity, we read that a study has found that Greenland ice melt has doubled in speed. A new study by a team of scientists in Canada and Northern Europe published in Nature shows that Greenland's ice sheet melted twice as fast between 2003 and 2010 as it did between 1900 and 1983. The study is the first look at Greenland ice loss in the 20th century to be based on observations rather than models. Greenland's ice sheet melt has been measured using satellites since 1992, but there wasn't any direct data on how much ice had melted before that, the researchers said. The new study estimates that from 2003 to 2010, Greenland dumped 186 billion metric tons of meltwater a year into the world's oceans, more than twice the annual rate that occurred between 1900 and 1983, which averaged 75 billion metric tons. Previous estimates have suggested that if all Greenland's ice melted, which might take thousands of years, it could raise global sea levels by more than 20 feet. And for more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and also at www.freakradio.org. If you want to listen to a rebroadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. Fridays, here, right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you're located near Moscow, Idaho, please tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, at 90.3 FM, where you can hear the Earth First Update at 3 p.m. on Wednesdays. And you can also tune in to Truth and Justice Radio on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, also 90.3 FM, between 6 and 10 a.m. on Sundays. On the Internet, you can listen to Grateful Dread Public Radio, an Internet radio station, where the Earth First Update is broadcast Sunday mornings at 2 a.m. Tune in to gdprnashville.org. That's gdprnashville.org. And you can also find Grateful Dread Public Radio on TuneIn.com and Spotify.com. Or you could go to radioforall.net, where you can listen online, or you can download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.